It is Monday, April 26th. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Ironically, this is the day annually, which used to be known in Georgia as Confederate Memorial Day. I say ironically in thinking about the subject of our conversation today. That changed when former Governor Nathan Deal stripped the day of the Confederate Memorial aspect, and now it's known on state calendar simply as state holiday. So welcome to a new day, at least in some ways, in the state of Georgia. We're going to be talking today to Andrew Filer, author, photographer. His new book of text and photographs, A Better Life for Their Children, has just been published. And before I introduce Andrew, and because it's Monday, my Monday partner, Jim Galloway, I want to read to you just briefly from the introduction to Andrew's book. This is a reminiscence by a man who is a legend across the country, a civil rights hero. And he recalls in the introduction his first day in school. Here's what he says. My first day of school was in many ways like that of any other child. I was up before dawn and fully dressed by the time the sun rose, way too excited to eat breakfast. My blue denim overalls, the same pair I had worked in all summer, were clean and pressed. I wore my favorite red flannel shirt, and on my feet were a pair of well-worn black brogans, the work boots I wore just about everywhere. Some of my classmates had to walk miles to and from school each day. For me, it was only a half-mile hike downhill to the Dunn's Chapel AME Church, beside which sat a small wooden building, whitewashed and with large windows. It was beautiful, and it was our school. Those are the words of John Lewis, recalling in the introduction to Andrew Filer's book, his first day of school. We're going to talk about that school and almost 5,000 others which have similar heritage with Andrew today. And of course, as I said, Jim Galloway, I'm glad you're here to be part of this conversation today too. Thanks, Jim.
No, I wouldn't miss this one for love nor money.
Andrew, thank you for being here. Let me introduce you a little bit more formally. Andrew grew up in Savannah, a long line of Jewish Georgians going back, I think, four or five generations in Savannah. Andrew, your brother Bruce has been a guest on this show on a couple of occasions. He too is an author. And you have been working in the nonprofit community, in politics for many years. Your photographs have been featured in the Wall Street Journal, Smithsonian, Slate, Oxford American, The Bitter Southerner, and so many others. You've had exhibitions at many, many illustrious venues, including the National Civil Rights Museum in Little Rock, Arkansas, and other locations like it. Andrew, thank you so much for being here today.
Bill, it's great to be with you. Thank you. And Jim, nice to be with you as well.
So let me start, Andrew. First of all, to have John Lewis, the late John Lewis, write the introduction to this book, it must have been one of the most special aspects of this entire experience for you.
I moved back to Atlanta in 1995. I have lived in the 5th Congressional District my entire time. That's 26 years. So I was a constituent of Congressman Lewis's for 25 years. And, you know, and I reached out to Congressman Lewis to ask him. He is one of the more well-known alumni of Rosenwald Schools. And I reached out to him and asked him if he would do the introduction to this book. And he said to me, you know, I'm not sure I'm comfortable writing about the history of Rosenwald Schools. What I know is I went to school there. And so I said to Congressman Lewis, you know, I will have an essay in this book. There will be an essay from a preservationist, a well-known preservationist at the State Historic Preservation Office, as well as an afterword from the person who heads up African-American preservation at the National Trust. We have plenty of people writing about the history of Rosenwald Schools. Congressman, what I want you to do is what only you can do. Bring me into that classroom. What was it like to go to school there? And talk about the role that education played in your life. And he said, oh, I can do that. And so I was with Congressman Lewis in his office working on this introduction with him and ultimately shooting his portrait that appears in the book on October 29th of 2019. And it was exactly 2 months later that he announced his diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. And while, you know, this was a photographic journey for me and a historiographical journey for me, to have had that extraordinary opportunity to work one-on-one with Congressman Lewis on his reflections and his passions was just one of the most extraordinary gifts of this entire experience.
So, Andrew, before we go too far into the show, we should tell people what basically your book is about. And I have to admit, Jim Galloway knew about the Rosenwald schools. I have to admit, until I got a copy of your book and read it, and by the way, it's a gorgeous book, Andrew. You deserve congratulations for the wonderful photography, the amazing stories you tell. But I didn't understand the partnership, the remarkable visionary partnership between Booker T. Washington, the educator, founder of Tuskegee Institute, and Julius Rosenwald, the president, CEO of Sears Roebuck. So that's really the starting point for the story. So why don't you help us understand how those two got together and what this great vision of theirs became?
So Julius Rosenwald is the son of Jewish immigrants who had fled religious persecution in Germany. And he grows up in Springfield, Illinois, directly across the street from Abraham Lincoln while Lincoln was resident in Springfield. And Rosenwald rises to become the president of Sears Roebuck and Company. He leads Sears from 1908 until his death in 1932, and he becomes one of the earliest and greatest philanthropists in American history. And his cause is what later becomes known as civil rights. Booker T. Washington, born into slavery in Virginia, becomes a passionate educator and is the founder of the historically black college in Alabama known as Tuskegee Institute. And the two men meet in 1911. And you have to remember, 1911 is before the Great Migration because it doesn't begin until later that decade. And so 90% of African Americans live in the South, and public schools for African Americans are mostly shacks, with a fraction of the funding provided to the education of white children. And so Booker T. Washington invites Julius Rosenwald to go on the board of Tuskegee, which he agrees to do, but they keep talking about what can we do together. And in 1912, they create this program that becomes known as Rosenwald Schools. And they reach out to the black communities of the South. And they say, we want you to be a full partner in your progress. And if you will contribute to a school, and we will count as your contribution cash, land, materials, and labor. And if you will go to the school board, the white school board, and get them to agree to own, maintain, and staff the school, pay for the teachers, because these will be public schools, and we want to deliberately create black-white dialogue, then Julius Rosenwald will make a substantial contribution towards school construction. And from 1912 to 1937, this program builds 4,978 schools across 15 southern and border states, and it transforms America.
It is breathtaking. It's breathtaking to think about what they accomplished. Jim, let me bring you into the conversation. Just to, you know, I want you to be here to talk to Andrew as well. But let's go back to what educational opportunities were not like for blacks in the late 19th century and into the middle of the 20th century. Plessy v. Ferguson, which was the Supreme Court's ruling that enshrined separate but equal into law, had an impact on virtually every aspect of institutional life, blacks and whites. And in schools, though, it had an enormous impact because it did create separate schools, but certainly not equal schools. And so black children... Go ahead, Jim. Yeah.
No. This was in the mid 1890s, and it green lighted Jim Crow across the South, and of course, I mean, transportation was one big issue. Access to retailed merchandise was another one. And we can get into that later. But education, of course, was the big one. And you had school systems across the South that didn't have any facilities for African American students. And then you had the ones that were just maybe not even second rate, third rate, fourth rate. You know, they would get cast off books from the white system. And it was just a miserable spiral of poverty.
So, Andrew, this is what, in many ways, one of the things that Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington were responding to. We've got to find a way to give black children decent educations. All right, so that happens. And you decide it's time to go out and document the schools that are still standing. In some cases, the building's still in use. In others, they're piles of rubble, as we see in the photographs in your book. That you traveled, what, 25,000 miles, I think you said, to shoot photographs of these schools all over. They were in the South and in the border states. And you went everywhere to see what you could find was left of what, I think about 500 that are still standing in some form or another, right?
Yeah, so I'll go back and just pick up one of the things that you said earlier, Bill. Sure. I found myself in early 2015 at lunch with a woman named Jeannie Syriac, who originated the role of African-American Heritage Specialist at the Georgia State Historic Preservation Office, and she was the first person to tell me about Rosenwald Schools. And I was like, how could I have never known this story, right? I'm a fifth-generation Jewish Georgian. I have been a progressive activist my entire life. The pillars of this story are the pillars of my life. And I came home from that lunch, and I Googled Rosenwald Schools. And what I found was that there were a series of books on the topic, but there had not been a photographic account of the program. And so I set out to create what turns out to be the first comprehensive photographic account of this program. And as you said, it was very clear to me from the very beginning. This program was in 15 states. My effort had to encompass all 15 states. And so I traveled to all 15 states. I drove 25,000 miles over 3.5 years. Of the original 4,978 schools, about 500 survive. Only about half of those have been restored. And I shot 105 schools, both interiors and exteriors, schools restored and yet to be restored. But the emotional heart of this story became the people that I met along the way, former students, former teachers, people who are trying to preserve these schools. And so I captured that part of this this journey and their stories through the portraits, But I'd simply add one more thing. This, on one hand, this is a book of photography, but I came across so many extraordinary stories that I felt compelled to write what turns out to be a short story that goes with every photograph or pair of photographs, because there are schools here that are directly connected to the Trail of Tears, to the Tuskegee Syphilis Study, to Tuskegee Airmen, to Brown, the legal case of Brown v. Board. And so all of those stories and the weave of Rosenwald Schools into this fabric of American culture are told in this book.
Hey, Andrew, yep. if I could jump in just with a couple quick questions. Number one, the one that I really have is does John Lewis's school still stand? Did it survive?
It did not.
That is just a terrific shame. Then secondly, I notice that I think virtually all of these photos are in black and white.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important and really good question, Jim, my process is to read and shoot and shoot and read, and the reading informs the shooting and the shooting informs the reading. And very early on, I came across this extraordinary story of the role that photography actually played in shaping the history of this program. The program begins with a pilot of six schools all close to Tuskegee so that Booker T. Washington and his team can keep an eye on this program. And Booker T. Washington has these photographs made of the students and teachers standing proudly in front of their school. And he sends them to Julius Rosenwald, who writes back that he is so moved by these images that he is committing to expanding the program. And these images continue to be made, excuse me, throughout the history of this program, and they become an important element of the visual narrative, the visual history of this program. And so it was in honor of those that I decided to shoot this entire body of work, both horizontal, because that is the linearity of the architecture and the linearity of these images, and in black and white. All of my previous bodies of work had been in color, but I felt that black and white was the right way to tell this story visually.
You know, one of the things that it stood out from, and there's so many wonderful photographs in this book, Andrew, but as long as you're talking about the pilot program, was it the Rosenwald Hall in Seminole County, Oklahoma? I was really touched by the photograph of that building because it reflects the architecture of the Southwest in such a vivid way. Am I right? Was that one of the pilot schools? Have I got that right?
No, the pilot schools were all within one or two counties of the location of Tuskegee. But you are correct that some of the schools in the border states do have slightly different architecture than the school. The schools in the South very consistently had these like very large windows to let in lots of light. But there's some schools in Maryland that had smaller windows and shutters because it's colder and the walls have to be structured differently to adjust to colder winters. And the Rosenwald, what becomes known as Rosenwald Hall in Lima, Oklahoma, is brick, and it's one of the earliest known brick Rosenwald schools. These schools, in the early days, were one and two, three teacher white clapboard buildings. By the end of the program, they're actually incentivizing brick construction because they realize these schools are actually going to be around for a while. And so you end up with one, two, and three-story red brick buildings. But that incentive doesn't kick in until 1928. Rosenwald Hall is built much, much earlier than that.
I realized that I think I'm on track. The Lochapoca School was actually the first school in the pilot. And the reason I wanted to mention it is because the total cost, you tell us, of that school, building that school, was $942.46. The black community contributed $150 to the project, whites in the community $360, and Rosenwald himself wrote a check for $300, and the school opened in 1913 and was still in use, you tell us, until the late 1950s. That's remarkable.
Well, I think the genius of this program, and it is the genius that Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington crafted together. Think about that structure. It is one of the earliest challenge grants. They didn't even have the term challenge grant back then, but it's a challenge grant. It is a public-private partnership because the public school system has to be part of the program. And Julius Rosenwald also was innovative. It's become very fashionable today for philanthropists to say that they want the funds to be given away within X number of years of their death or in their lifetime. Julius Rosenwald is the first major philanthropist to do that. He said he mandated that all funds must be given away within 25 years of his death. And so both the structure of this program and the fundamental orientation of the philanthropy model here, engaging the beneficiary in their own progress is hugely important. And it's a milestone in the history of American philanthropy.
Andrew, we mentioned John Lewis. Who else that we might recognize benefited from these schools?
So there are one of the legacies of this program is that many of the foot leaders and the foot soldiers of the civil rights movement come through these schools. Medgar Evers, Maya Angelou, four or five of the members of the Little Rock Nine who go on to integrate Little Rock Central High School all attended Rosenwald schools. But then there is the second generation effect. So, for example, there are ancestors of Spike Lee, former Attorney General Loretta Lynch, who went to, and in fact, Oprah Winfrey has an ancestor who was involved with Rosenwald Schools.
You talk about famous people who have some connection, either went there or, you know, have a different connection. You tell us that Valerie Jarrett's, I think, great-grandfather was the architect who began the project. And there was something about the project. The requirement was these buildings were supposed to be modest in design, right? Humble and very kind of straightforward, I think, is a word that I would use to describe them, right? Yeah. And that was Valerie Jarrett's great-grandfather?
Yes, so Valerie Jarrett's great-grandfather was a man named Robert Robinson Taylor. He's the first African-American to attend MIT and the first accredited African-American architect. And he is hired by Booker T. Washington to be the chief architect and an architect in architecture instructor at Tuskegee. He designs most of the famous and beautiful buildings on the Tuskegee campus. And he leads a team of architects to design the first round of Rosenwald Schools. And he lays out a certain architectural language. This is the progressive movement. This is architecture in service of education. Big windows to let in lots of light, because at the time, most of these schools did not have electricity, right? Outhouses, privies, which are actually designed in the manual so that they are properly constructed. Those are away from the building, right? Cloakrooms, so that dirty outer garments will be kept in separate spaces and not dirty the educational spaces. Potbelly stoves that keep the classrooms warm during winter months, and they vent through these brick chimneys. And then, and really significantly, room dividers that are a series of folding doors that keep the classrooms separate during classroom hours, but can be folded back and to open up the spaces so that they can be community gathering spots outside of education hours. These basic principles are laid out by Robert Robinson Taylor in 1912, and they persist through the entire program. But overall, there is this other standard that he sets, which is that these buildings are to be modest, and they're to be modest for two reasons. One reason they're to be modest is to save cost. Another is so that they don't provoke the ire, otherwise known as arson, from the local white citizenry.
And were they successful in that end? I mean, did you have any targeted schools?
So there is a history of these. There is a history of some of the schools burning. The school in my book from Brevard, North Carolina, is the second school on that location. The previous school burned down. Film director and Broadway director George Wolfe is in my book. He attended a school that was the third school. It's on the campus of Kentucky State University in Frankfort. It was the third school in that location. The first two burned. Now, do we have evidence that any of those burnings were specifically arson? I have not found that in the literature. But they're considering that these schools did not have electricity, considering that there is a history of burning, there's some dots to be connected.
Yeah. Roughly speaking, I mean, was there a standard number of students that these buildings were able to serve at one time?
Well, so the schools are laid out based on the number of teachers. So there's one-teacher schools, two-teacher schools, four-teacher schools, and so all the way up to 18 teacher schools, and it varies. But we certainly know that in most of these classrooms, the one teacher would teach, say, classes. And John, look, Congressman Lewis is the Duns Chapel School. It's a two teacher school. One teacher taught grades 1 through 4. The other teacher in the next room taught grades 5 through 8. We have certainly lots of evidence of students crowding into these classrooms, 50 students in a room with one teacher. But it varies widely by geography.
Let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show, excuse me, out of the way. When we come back, Jim Galloway and I will continue our conversation with Andrew Filer, his new book, A Better Life for Their Children, Julius Rosenwald, Booker T. Washington, and the 4,978 schools that changed America. This is Political Rewind. Andrew Filer, in the subtitle for your book, A Better Life for Their Children, you talk about the 4,978 schools that changed America, and that's actually based on a study. They did change America. You have a photograph in the book of two economists for the Federal Reserve who did a study of the schools and documented the impact these schools had on American life. Tell us a little bit about what they learned.
So these are two economists at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago who have actually done five studies of Rosenwald schools. They are labor economists, and what their data shows is that prior to World War I, there was a large and persistent black-white education gap in the South. That gap closes precipitously between World War I and World War II. And the single greatest driver of that achievement, and I think we have to acknowledge it is an achievement, is Rosenwald schools. And not only that, their data shows that there is a second-order effect. People who attended Rosenwald schools had children who were substantially more likely to have higher levels of educational achievement. People who attended Rosenwald schools had better financial outcomes. And people who attended Rosenwald schools were actually more likely to leave the South as part of the Great Migration, where they had likely greater economic outcomes. And so for all of those reasons, the program there is data to support the argument that this program is transformative and helps set the foundation for the civil rights movement. And in addition, as we talked earlier, many of the leaders and foot soldiers of the movement come through these schools. And so it's an important foundation for the civil rights movement to come.
Jim, I want to zero in just for a moment, at least, on the Georgia Rosenwald schools. Andrew tells us that in Georgia, 243 Rosenwald schools were built in 103 counties across the state. I was struck by the fact that the school in Washington County, the principal and I think and spouse and a teacher and spouse are buried in the front of the school. That's how meaningful, Jim, this school was to them. And as long as we're talking Georgia stories, I was really taken by another story about the Friendship School in Chattahoochee County. FDR, when he would make his stay down at the little White House in Warm Springs, got to know one of those schools and urged Rosenwald to build another school in Meriwether County, which ended up bearing Eleanor Roosevelt's name. And Jim, he actually donated the money that was needed to complete the project. That in and of itself is just one of the wonderful stories Andrew tells in his book, Jim.
Yeah. Andrew, how many in Georgia? How many of these schools are still standing? And what is being done to help preserve them?
So the last count that I'm aware of, there's about 40 schools that have survived in Georgia, but most of those have not been restored. I have been to about 10 of those schools. Some of them have been turned into museums. There's one up in Bartow County, and the Noble Hill School is this beautiful museum that honors, that tells the story of African American culture and life in North Georgia. There's one on the campus of Fort Valley State University, which is still an active educational space. But the very last Rosenwald School in Warm Springs was boarded up for a very long time and has recently been acquired with the assistance of the Georgia Trust for Historic Preservation. And they're working on plans to restore that and bring it back as a community center.
Now you've got an exhibit coming up in Atlanta May 22nd. And is that geared toward at least raising an awareness, if not cash, for the preservation effort?
So let me take a half a step back. I mean, I think as a photographer who tells stories related to history, what my images do, I think, and I hope, is bring people into the story. It's a way of finding a door into these important historical moments and contemporary moments. One of the core messages within this story is the plea for preservation, because we had 4,978 schools. We have 500 left. We have lost 90% of these schools, but only half of the ones that survive have been restored. And as Bill mentioned earlier, there are times on this journey that I came across schools that had collapsed so recently that they were surrounded by emergency fencing or yellow caution tape. And I document that. Those images are included in this project because there is an inherent plea for preservation. These buildings are the center of memory and community, and we need to preserve that part of our heritage. The exhibition is another way of bringing people into the story. And so there's 85 photographs in this book. There'll be 25 in the exhibition, printed very large. And that exhibition opens May 22nd at the Center for Civil and Human Rights in downtown Atlanta. It will be up through December 12th. And then the exhibition will travel from there. And it will go to Charlotte, Memphis, Nashville, New Orleans, Richmond, and then beyond.
We should point out, Andrew, that your book has already published, by the way, we should point out, by the University of Georgia Press, which published your earlier book. And I don't want to let the show go by without noting that your earlier book, Without Regard to Sex, Race, or Color, focused on an abandoned campus of a historically black, where was the college in the earlier book that was part, it's all part of your commitment to civil rights, telling the stories of civil rights and education, among other things. Tell us just a bit about that.
Yes. Yeah, so my first book, Without Regard to Sex, Race, or Color, is a portrait of the largely abandoned campus of Morris Brown College here in Atlanta, one of the six historically black colleges that make up Atlanta University Center. Morris Brown had just gone into bankruptcy when I started on that journey with the collaboration of the college. I think it's really important to note that Morris Brown is now in the process of regaining accreditation, which is an incredibly important moment we should all celebrate. But what I did with that book was use these empty educational spaces that we are all familiar with. We have walked these hallways. We have stood in these types of classrooms, but we're used to them being populated by teachers and students and the educational process instead of a space populated by ghosts. And what I used that framework to raise awareness about the central role that education has played as the backbone of the American dream. The commitment to public education in America goes back 376 years now, to 1644, when the first publicly funded school was created in Dedham, Massachusetts. And there's a direct connection between that moment, land-grant colleges, which were created in 1862, historically black colleges created largely in the decades after the Civil War, Rosenwald schools in the early decades of the 20th century, the educational provisions of the GI Bill, which transform America from relatively poor to relatively prosperous, to Brown v. Board of Education, to the challenges we're talking about today, college affordability, college access. This 376-year tradition is a tradition at risk because of these affordability issues, and I think it impresses upon all of us the necessity of ensuring that education can continue to be the on-ramp to the American middle class.
What I started to mention before my mind wandered off onto the sidetrack about the Morris Brown book is you've already gotten, the book has already created, your new book, great impact. I mean, I opened up my Saturday Wall Street Journal to a double page spread about this new book. So you have truly, I think, in an important moment in time, touched a nerve here. And let me just speculate on something and then ask you to comment on it. You grew up Jewish in Georgia. You are certainly not unfamiliar with anti-Semitic bigotry. You have long been a champion of civil rights for African Americans. So for you to come across the story of an African American and a Jewish philanthropist who came together to create these schools must have been a remarkable moment of convergence.
Absolutely. I think that, look, the Black-Jewish Alliance that becomes one of the backbones of the civil rights movement begins with Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington. And there is a direct connection. But and you have to remember, they not only have a partnership, they have a deep friendship. You can see it in their letters. And there's a direct connection from that moment to Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel marching arm in arm with Dr. King, who famously says that when he marches with King, I felt like my feet were praying, to just earlier this year, where for 2 months, John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock campaigned across this state together. And you can tell from their dynamic that that was not just political. That was they developed a close friendship that is at work today in the United States Senate. Georgia sends its first Jewish member to the United States Senate, its first African-American member to the United States Senate. And the Warnock-Ossoff relationship stands on the shoulders of that of Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington.
Yeah, Andrew, if we could get flip the script and go back in history just a little bit, this relationship between Booker T. Washington and Rosenwald didn't just happen. Sears Roebuck played an incredible role in the in subverting Jim Crow in the South. Do you get into that in the book at all?
You know, There, as you know, Jim, there's this thing in politics called message containment. So I am certainly well aware. It's funny, actually. There's certain stories that I came across that I would love to have told and that I didn't get a chance to tell. And some of them relate to this. So what Jim's getting at is the simple fact that mail order that was enabled through the creation of rural free delivery, which has its roots in a controversial figure in Georgia political history, enabled African Americans to order goods through this catalog and avoid the indignities forced upon them when they tried to purchase goods from white merchants. The rules like you can't wear anything. Go ahead, Jim.
Galloway, you wrote a terrific column about that a while back. I want to get into that with you and Andrew when we come back from our final break of the show. Again, our guest, Andrew Filer, A Better Life for Their Children. We'll be back in a moment. So Andrew Filer, in addition to everything else about you as an artist, as a writer and photographer, you must have an amazing Twitter following, because when I tweeted out that you were going to be on the show, I don't think I've ever gotten so many retweets and likes. I think we need to get to know you a lot better, Andrew. It really is wonderful to see the community that's come together around you and your book.
The reception to this book has just been extraordinary, as you said. I mean, in my wildest dreams as a photographer, I certainly didn't expect a double-page spread in the Wall Street Journal that's just so exquisitely laid out. You just marvel at it as a work of art. We have a piece coming in the May issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and this book went into a second printing 2 days in advance of the original publication date. And so it has been incredibly gratifying. And actually, I'll just... If you give me 1 second here, Bill, I'll just read this. This is a solitary enterprise, right? I drove 25,000 miles largely by myself. I sat at my desk for hours on Google and Google Maps looking for Rosenwald schools and stories associated with Rosenwald schools. And then I get an email like this from a photographer in Michigan that I have never met and do not know. He writes, "Truly, this may be the best example of documentary work and storytelling combined I have ever seen. You have captured the honor, wow, dignity, strength, and maybe even aspirations of a marginalized and disadvantaged group, completely humanizing their situation in a most compelling fashion. You know,
wow.
You want that on your tombstone.
Yeah. So, Jim, Rosenwald, you wrote about Rosenwald, and we talked briefly about it before the break, but Rosenwald really, truly, truly was a visionary leader as a businessman. Before there was what we call the civil rights movement, Julius Rosenwald understood what was important about finding ways to create equal lives for African Americans in this country. Talk just a little bit about how he kind of transformed black buying in the South with Sears.
Well, he headed up the Amazon.com of the 19th century. I think it's very to say to that. The story begins back in 1893. You had a wayward Georgia politician named Tom Watson, who would go on to infamy as a racial polemicist. Sparking the 1906 Atlanta riots and the lynching of Leo Frank. But perhaps his one good deed was he pushed through rural free delivery during the single term that he was in Congress. And this was the concept that you don't go to the post office comes to you. And look, in a society that was rapidly shutting out African Americans, newly freed African Americans, this became a lifeline. It really was a lifeline. You did not need the store manager's permission to purchase this dress or that tie or this shoe. You did not have to wait while every white customer was served before they got to you. So it became at this time, remember Sears, just the role that Sears Roebuck played in the West. You could order an entire house from Sears Roebuck, and they would deliver it to your doorstep, or I guess your soon to be doorstep. But you had this bond developing between African Americans and Rosenwald and his company, even before Booker T. Washington and this partnership with Booker T. Washington formed. It lasted well into the civil rights movement. I spoke with Andy Young. You're referencing a column that I did maybe 2.5 years ago, but I was talking to Andy Young. He was a young pastor of two congregations in Thomasville, back in the late 50s, and the Sears store, I guess it was in Tallahassee, across the border, 60 miles away, was the only place that he felt safe in shopping. The relationship between Sears and African Americans is just so fascinating.
Andrew, I want to, with the time remaining, I'm glad that Jim talked about how important Rosenwald was even before he met with Booker T. Washington and they launched this incredible adventure, the two of them. But can we pick out just a couple of the stories in your book that you came across? And I have one in mind because it relates to a Georgian. You talk about Webster Wheeler, who grew up in Cassville, Georgia. And he was part of the Great Migration. He went north, but something brought him back. Tell us just a tiny bit about his story.
Yeah, you know, the Great Migration is just one of the transformative events in the 20th century of America. It is the largest internal movement of people in world history. when the Great Migration begins in the early, in the mid-1910s, 90% of African Americans live in the South. By the time the Great Migration ends at the end of the 1960s, 56% of African Americans live in the South. I want to jump ahead and acknowledge something incredibly, one of the most important things going on in America today is the reversal of the Great Migration. African Americans moving back to the South. It is transforming the politics and the demographics of Georgia. But Webster Wheeler embodies this story. He leaves Cassville, Georgia, and goes and is part of the Great Migration, goes to Detroit, and has an entire career as a carpenter for Ford Motor Company, and then finds out that his tiny town of Cassville has been awarded a Rosenwald's grant, and he moves back. And along with one other member of the community, single-handedly builds the Noble Hill School. And there is a photograph of Webster Wheeler that hangs in that school. And the important thing about that photograph is this. Isabel Wilkerson, whose book, Warmth of Other Suns, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning wonderful treatise on the Great Migration. Isabel lives here in Atlanta. And she writes that when migrants went north, one of the first things that they did when they landed in their new city was had their portrait taken because it was a sign that they had arrived in their promised new land. And so that talisman of Webster Wheeler's journey hangs in the schoolhouse, which is now restored, which he helped build.
Jim, that just some of the remarkable stories in this book about the passion with which people came to the schools around the South.
Yeah, it's what's interesting here is that, you know, we all seek a certain commonality. It's become more and more important right now. And what I think this book really shows us is that whether you're an immigrant, whether you're not an immigrant, whether you came here voluntarily, whether you did not come here voluntarily, education is kind of universally recognized as the tool for getting ahead. And it was true when the Irish came, it was true when the Germans came, and it's true when slaves were given their freedom. The first thing they sought was an education.
Yeah, Andrew, that's a theme that emerges time and time again in the stories of people who were part of the Rosenwald schools.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's an important thread that I came across, and these, as I mentioned, I kept coming across the folks that had these connections to these schools. And what I found was students who became teachers, who then become the people in their community leading the efforts to restore these schools. And so student becomes teacher, becomes the keeper of the flame of history and memory. And it's an inspiring life thread that I came across time and time again.
You talk about, you have a photograph of Charles Albert and Ernie Tyson, who they met, they ended up getting married. Charles Albert went into the Army after the end of World War II. Ernie Tyson, his wife, became an educator. And when they got married, she insisted that he get a college degree, and together they became teachers. And they're part of the Rosenwald School movement. That's just another one of the extraordinary stories in this book.
They were classmates in the Peck School in Fernandina Beach in class of 1949. And Charles goes off to the Army. Ernie becomes a teacher. And they on Fernandina Beach is on Amelia Island, which has American Beach, one of the black segregated beaches. And they go for this fateful walk on the beach. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because there's a wonderful twist to the story I didn't get to fit into the book. They're on this moonlit walk on Fernandina Beach, and they talk about laying out a life together. And Charles says to Ernie, "You know, I don't really think I'm a college kind of guy." And Ernie says, "No college, no Ernie." And Charles says, "Okay, I'll go to college." And they both become educators in the school that they attended, and then roll forward, and the school closes, it's boarded up. Charles runs for mayor, becomes the first African-American mayor in Fernandina, and leads the restoration of this school. And Ernie, comes out of retirement and opens a children's library in her old fourth grade classroom. And the photograph of them is in that classroom.
As we come to a close, Andrew, do you mind if I read a passage from your book back to you and Jim?
Please.
You say this: as I heard more and more stories about Rosenwald School people, I came to understand that the people I met share something profound. They're part of a quiet multi-generational movement, a movement that began with the dreams of slaves for book learning, continued during Reconstruction as freed blacks, young and old. And you go on from there to talk about, and we're running out of time, so I can't complete that. But the Rosenwald schools, which you document in A Better Life for Their Children, tells the story of the quest for education that Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington were able to fulfill for thousands and thousands of black students across the South. Andrew Filer, thank you. Jim Galloway, I'm completely out of time, but we're back tomorrow. I'm Bill Nygut. Till tomorrow, take care, stay healthy, wear your mask above your nose, and get the vaccine if you haven't gotten it so far. Take care, everybody.